Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
During the summer when the weather gets hot, I can only imagine how much time you plan to spend outside with friends or alone on your couch with that AC blasting. AT&T 5G and home internet keeps you connected so you can enjoy all the summertime vibes, whether you're sharing pics from a rooftop, video calling your friends from an outdoor concert, or streaming your favorite show episode after episode. So, stay connected to your favorite people and your favorite things with AT&T 5G and home internet. AT&T 5G requires compatible plan and device. Coverage not available everywhere. Learn more at att.com/5G for you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of 100 Words or Less, the podcast. I am your host, Ray Harkins, and I'm sitting here with a new microphone, trying a little new mic, see how this sounds. But anyways, we're at episode number 48, and the guest this week is Doc Coyle, the guitarist from New Jersey metal band God Forbid. I realized that I had another New Jersey metal band last week, so we're pretty metal as of late, but it'll be delving into some different stuff shortly, so keep your eyes and ears peeled. Anyways, propertyofzach.com. We'll get some business out of the way first. They are a great site. Go visit them. Visit them a lot. Find out about what bands are doing. Find out about what independent culture is happening and popping. They did some great coverage on South by Southwest. And just go there to be up to date on everything. Shout out to our editor, Tom Richfield. He is doing a killer job, and hopefully the audio quality will keep on improving. I'm doing things now more professionally than I ever have, so it's awesome. And Tom's got great ideas, so shout out to him. Review the show on iTunes. You can drop some stars, or you can drop some sentences. Either way, I've been noticing some people are kind and been dropping some, you know, very nice reviews. And I really do appreciate that. I literally read every one and go, thank you. Either in my head or audibly. Sometimes if I know the person, I'm like, hey, thanks on some social network. So anyways, keep on doing that. I really appreciate that. And secondly, I'll be doing this for a few shows and I apologize, but this is kind of just the one thing that I'm fixated on currently. So there's a website called theavclub.com, and they do a column called Podmass, which is basically reviews of podcasts. And, you know, they do obviously the most gigantic, famous ones, but occasionally they do a show where it says new to us, which is basically just like, oh, hey, this is a new podcast you should check out. I want this show featured on there. That would be incredible. So the only thing you need to do, the listener, would basically be just email them. So the email address is podmass@avclub.com and just be like, hey, you should listen to 100 Words or Less. It's a great show. There's good interviews, blah, blah, blah. And I think, honestly, if maybe like 10 of you did that, that would be spectacular, because I think that's all they would need in order to be like, oh, hey, someone should check this out. So yes, podmass@avclub.com. If you forget the email address, just find me on Twitter, whatever. I'll remind you. Anyways, before we get into the interview, I have dove into a YouTube hole the other day. And if you haven't done that, I highly recommend it. You can get like, you know, an hour out of your day being like, oh my God, how did I end up here? So for those of you that don't live in Southern California, because I am fairly certain that this guy was not nationally syndicated or had any sort of national awareness. He did appear on the Howard Stern show occasionally. But so there's a guy named Wally George. Go to YouTube, type in Wally George. You're up for a treat. But just to put it in context, the dude, it's kind of like, you know, when public access television was a thing, for those of you that don't even know what that means, like think of the movie Wayne's World, how they were doing a show from their basement. And, you know, just similar to podcasts where it's like, hey, you know, maybe someone's listening and whatever. They would broadcast that on local television networks on off hours, either really late or it's usually really late. Wally George was a mainstay in the Southern California, you know, public access television. I just always remember, you know, 9, 10, 11, having the TV on, you know, at like midnight or 1 in the morning. It was a little bit older, but it was absolutely incredible. It was basically like Jerry Springer before it was Jerry Springer, but it was so lopsided. Basically, whoever the guest was that Wally brought in, he would just completely lampoon them. And usually it was people that you could obviously easily lampoon, from, you know, white supremacists to, you know, racists, whatever. But I'm not going to explain it too much because the videos are just absolutely incredible. They basically got dudes from the beach to fill the audience. And it was just this total hangout atmosphere with this super electric host who was just basically chanting America the whole time. I don't know. It's just, it's amazing. And I'm really glad that I experienced this. And I'm sure so many of you have these other random stories of like, there was this guy on late night television and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not talking, obviously, David Letterman, Jay Leno, Johnny Carson, stuff like that. This is like deep dive. Anyways, go do that and your life will be better because of that. Anyways, Doc Coyle, God forbid, they've been a band for a long time. And at this point, there should be no reason that they're continuing to put out records, as far as the mass media, we recycle bands every 10 minutes mentality is concerned. But they're an incredible band. I will regale a story to Doc in regards to the first time that I heard the band. But yeah, we talked about race, because he's a black man and he plays in a metal band, and that doesn't happen very often. So we talked about that. We talked about longevity and his motivation to create art. So yeah, he's a great dude, and I hope you learned something from this, because he definitely dominates the conversation, which is awesome, because that's what I want on this whole show. So he definitely guides you through a lot of stuff. So check it out, and I'll talk to you after.
Really fascinating conversations.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point too. So yeah, usually I like to start things off with just kind of my own personal sort of entry point into, you know, you as a person and, you know, your musical output over the years and stuff. It was definitely around the time when God Forbid put out Determination. Like, it was shortly before that, because being from the West Coast, like, you know, bands that were on the East Coast, like, you know, it took a moment for the news to trickle out here to be like, oh, check this band out, they're awesome. But I distinctly remember, like, leaving a show at, like, the Key Club in Hollywood and being handed one of the Canderia, God Forbid, tapes, like a sampler tape with, like, two songs from Determination.
The now legendary sampler tape.
Dude, it's so funny, because it's like, you know, you can always, like, especially people like you and I have been involved for music for way too long, where it's like you kind of forget how important those, like, you know, samplers or whatever are, where it's just like, that's like, you know, I still remember that. Like, and so I remember listening to it and being like, holy shit, like, what is this? Because, you know, like, obviously most people will say to you, it's like, you know, you guys combined like a lot of the, you know, sort of hardcore elements that, you know, a lot of bands in the mid 90s did, but then you obviously kind of pushed it forward with the love for, you know, the Swedish death metal and all that type of stuff. And I just remember being so like taken aback and being like, why have I not heard of this band? And I need to find as much out as I possibly can. So did that tape you find, like, more than one person has been like, oh, Doc, like, that tape turned me on to your band?
Well, it's that era of the band is really kind of paradoxical in a lot of ways, because it was the era in which a big portion of people found out about the band. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. also the era where we first started hitting the road and touring and just really, like, we went for broke, you know. For some reason, from our perspective, like, that album cycle was kind of like, it didn't meet our expectations. So in a lot of ways, we never really got to connect with the impact of that album the way I think a lot of people did. And it didn't really become apparent to us till like several years later, after it came out, that Determination had a really big impact on a certain sect of music fans. And then by that time, we had kind of went in another direction somewhat, you know. Yeah. So but that was, you know, it's funny you bring up the sampler tapes. It's like, that was 2001. So you really got to remember, you know, people having demo tapes at their shows was only like 2 years before that.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? So having an actual sampler tape of like Century Media Records, and then obviously Candiria was a, you know, groundbreaking band.
Yeah.
You know? And that was like, we were like the new band on that sampler. Like, yeah. I mean, half people were getting that, oh, let me check out these new Candiria tunes. And then they got to check us out too. I remember they handed them out at New England Metal Fest that year.
Oh yeah.
And that was back when, like, New England Metal Fest, like, you had a good set in New England that had an impact in the heavy metal world. Like, it's kind of spread around, like, yo, that band really killed it. And, you know, it had reverberations in terms of the industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a much smaller bubble, I'd say, of influence. And it would take, like you said, a while before things reached to the West Coast, mm-hmm. you know, and there'd be, like, these little pockets, you know, of scenes, like, where people were kind of in the know, you know. It's like, you know, in like Orange County, you know, so we didn't even know this at the time. And then, like, a couple years after that, you know, like, Atreyu took us on tour, mm-hmm. and they were like huge fans, and they were like, and they would like give us, like, you know, we had taken Avenged Sevenfold out like maybe like a year after Determination came out, and they were just giving us like all these stories of how, like, we're like legends in like, yo, man, you guys are huge in OC. I'm like, right, sure.
Right, sure, whatever.
at the time, we, like, on that, part of the reason why we didn't think that album was really successful was it actually sold a good amount of records. I think mm-hmm. we had, well, at that time, I think we'd sold like 15 or 20,000 copies, which was really good for an mm-hmm. underground band. But we weren't really, like, doing really great headlining shows. Like, people weren't really coming out to the shows. So it was hard to feel like how it was. Like, that tour, we did a tour. It was us headlining, Bleeding Through as main support, mm-hmm. and Avenged Sevenfold opened.
Sure.
And this was like, I think, the end of summer 2002. And it was like 50 people every night, just shot. And most of them were there for Bleeding Through.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
We're like, we sold all these records. We toured with Opeth's first tour ever with Nevermore. We toured Cradle of Filth in their first U.S. tour. We toured 6 Feet Under and Lamb of God. We toured with Gwar. We toured with Hatebreed.
Right. You're like, we did all this stuff, but why is nobody coming to see us?
we did everything that we thought we could do. And at the time, we actually had the this management company called The Syndicate managing us, and they also managed Shadows Fall. Uh-huh. And Shadows Fall, you know, had put out Of One Blood like a year earlier and kind of did the same thing we did. You know, they did every tour, they busted their ass, and they had like, I think they had sold like 10,000 more records, but like that 10,000 to like our manager and the label was like, yeah, they're the big dogs. You guys are the, you're the backup team, you know, we need you, you know, and they were like a little more commercial, you know, they had some of the clean vocals and stuff. And it was always kind of put in this narrative that part of the reason why we weren't breaking through was because we were a little too edgy, a little too heavy, a little too weird, you know. And I think somehow that might have burrowed into our brains a little bit when we were possibly like writing the next record.
Yeah. You
know? And that's it's a weird thing. Like, you know, you can never go back and kind of rewrite the storybook on how a band ends up sounding like they're going to sound like or where they're going to be. But I've such an interesting relationship with all of our albums because they're all so different, and there's such a different mindset behind every album. And I think every mindset was legitimized.
Sure. Well, yeah, you see, it's one of those things where it's like you see why the band reacted how they did, like you said, with each record, because of, you know, a set of circumstances, a set of experiences. So yeah, no, I totally get that. But before we dive too deep into that, you know, I want to know you, Doc. So yeah, born and raised, were you born on the East Coast in Jersey? Like, is that where you kind of cut your teeth?
Yeah, I was born in Rahway, New Jersey, but grew up in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Of course.
Which is the home of Rutgers University, which made it a really kind of a cool city because it was a small city. I think like at the time the population was only about 50,000 people. It was, you know, the environment was pretty, you know, it was a collegiate environment. So even though, you know, I never went to Rutgers, you kind of felt like you were, you know, there was more culture there than I'd say some just like crappy ghetto in Jersey. Mm-hmm. And we also had like some neighbors, you know, that were like grad students. So it was kind of part of, you know, it was kind of the backdrop of growing up. And it's, you know, I can't really even talk about growing up without talking about my brother Dallas, who was in the band, because he's only like a year older than me, and we basically like attached at each other's hips from the time I was born till, you know, we were 30 years old. So
this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're sitting here, it's like June, and you're like, where has the time gone? And everybody's like, oh my gosh, I have no idea. I got to like accomplish all these other things. Take a moment. Focus on the things that obviously for one matter to you, but for two, look back, be like, what have I done well? What have I done not so well? And maybe I can, you know, ask some friends and family for some help. But where I have always gone to in regards to figuring out what I can do better, therapy. Therapy is an incredible tool at your arsenal that you can dip into. I've done it for my marriage. I've done it for myself personally. And I'm a huge advocate for what therapy can do for you because it is a third party that's able to look at what you can do to improve your life and be a person to help you along in your journey. And so I think if you were thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and entirely suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched with a licensed therapist, and then boom, you're done. It's great. And then if you're not vibing with the therapist, you can switch it at no additional cost. So take a moment, reflect on the things you've done, reflect on the things you want to do, and visit betterhelp.com/ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ray.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs.
on demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right, right. As you were growing up, well, is it just you two guys as far as like siblings are concerned?
Yeah.
Okay. And what did your parents do like as you were growing up, and like what was the family structure like?
Well, the family structure was a little weird. So me and my brother are mixed race. We're half black and half white. And my father was and still is a piano player, and my mother was a singer, and they actually met as you know, playing in the same band.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so this goes back to like, you know, the 70s. My mother was like a jazz singer. You know, they never got married. Mm-hmm. And if you were to meet them today, you would think they were like, they're about as different people as you could ever meet, you know.
Sure.
So they split when I was like 5, and then lived with my mother for a few years, and then eventually my father got custody, and we pretty much just lived with our father from the time I was like 9 or 10 till, you know, so I was growing up.
Sure, sure. Obviously, as you were kind of, you know, growing up and started to understand like, oh, hey, like, you know, my friend's parents are married or whatever. Like, you know, how did that sit with you? Or was it just like, oh, this is kind of normal for what I'm used to?
Well, I think, you know, we never had a lot, you know, like I think when you're a kid and you're kind of poor, you don't really know you're poor, you know?
Sure.
You know, until you go around people that maybe have more than you. But and still to this day, you know, my approach to that is that, you know, you just be thankful for whatever you do have. If you, as a, you know, as a philosophy, are always just kind of trying to keep up with the Joneses or are always focused on what you don't have, then you know it's going to be very hard to be happy at anything. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it was my father basically raising us by himself as a piano teacher. So he'd be gone all day. You know, me and my brother would kind of be left to our own devices, you know. Mm-hmm. And I knew that he was doing his best, and I knew he loved us, and I didn't begrudge that at all. Like, I don't know, like I think some of that kind of like baby boomer stuff, like, oh, my parents weren't there for me. Dad didn't play catch with me, you know, cat in the cradle stuff, you know.
Right.
That's cool, you know, and it's nice you're kind of, you know, taking your inventory, but being a parent's hard, paying the rent is hard.
Sure.
And, you know, the thing about my father, he had a teaching degree, so he could have taught regular school, and, you know, he really wanted to run his own business. And my father's a really, really unique guy. He's, you know, just a true artist, you know, and he knows. He's the most well-read person I know. He has a wall full of books, and he's actually read them all. Some, you know, culturally, a guy, he identifies with black culture probably more than he does with white culture, which is very unique. But I don't mean that like in his mannerisms or like the way he dressed or anything. It's just that's his. I knew when it was Louis Armstrong's birthday or Duke Ellington's birthday. That would be on the radio, and my dad, you know, he made sure to constantly be educating me in some way, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was, you know, showing me and my brother the Marx Brothers or old Muhammad Ali fights, or, you know, documentaries on the Holocaust or the Great Depression, you know, and, you know, really kind of giving me as much ammo in terms of so than I was getting at school.
Well, it sounds like obviously like. Not everybody, you know, even though, like you said, you know, you came from modest means, your dad was obviously, he understood that, you know, for whatever he couldn't give you monetarily, he was obviously trying to culture, you know, you and your brother and be like, hey, here's some cool stuff that, you know, you should be aware of. And like, you know, because obviously it's that delicate balance of like you know, looking at how parents are, all right, I have to show my kids like what I would think I would define as cool and like, you know, what they should know, but obviously not forcing it on them. So they'll be like, oh, fuck you, dad. Like, I'm going to get into my own shit. You know, that'll happen later, obviously. But
yeah, the thing is, though, my dad, he was at the same time, he was listening to Public Enemy and Rage Against the Machine and Pearl Jam and Nirvana. He was just a cool motherfucker,
yeah.
You know, like, and he still is, you know, like my dad, you know, my dad, this dude went to the library and took out Tupac CDs. And he's like, Doc, you got to listen to this Tupac. This stuff is great.
So good.
You know? Yeah. The dude's just the shit. He played on our couple of our records.
Oh no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He did for Earth's Blood. He did the intro, the piano intro. And then he did, a piece on a song called The Lonely Dead on Constitution of Treason.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, that's obviously awesome that you're able to, you know, experience that as a true family, so to speak.
Coin the term dad forbid.
Right. I love it. And so obviously as you were, you know, kind of growing up and, you know, your formative years, like obviously for one, music was an important part of your life. So, you know, as you started to transition to like high school and stuff like that, what sort of, you know, were you into sports or like what were you doing at that time?
It was weird because, you know, if you look at me now, you'd think I would have been like a track star or football or something because I'm 6'2", like 200 pounds in pretty good shape. But I had no coordination when I was really young. Mm-hmm. So like I tried to play baseball and I couldn't do it, didn't like it. And I was, you know, kind of, you know, a little kind of chubby kid or whatever. And then my first year of high school, I discovered basketball and started playing. But I wasn't really good. It wasn't until my sophomore year that I actually started playing on the team. And I was pretty obsessed with basketball. I still am. I still play. I do, I don't know if you see my NBA blog.
I have.
Metal Sucks, you know. So I'm nerdy about that. No, I think, you know, for me, I think about my high school years as definitely being an awkward kid. And maybe that wasn't the way the world saw me, but that's maybe, I think, how I saw me, as, you know, and maybe to this day as someone who never truly fits in. Mm-hmm. And maybe that has something to do with being biracial. I'm also, I think I have a loner streak in me. And anytime a group of people coalesce around a set of set ideas, I immediately become wary of it and suspicious. And, you know, I hate groupthink, you know, even as a kid, like I didn't understand gangs. I was like, so what, you hang out together for what? I don't, you know, I never really felt the, actually the first time I felt comfortable somewhere was when I discovered the hardcore scene. And to this day, I'll tell everyone, you know, me and my brother, we were metal guys. We favored heavy metal music. You know, the way we got into music was Metallica, Pantera, Guns N' Roses, Megadeth, Sepultura, Slayer. And then we discovered the hardcore scene. You know, I would have described myself as a hardcore kid, but a metalhead. Like, sure. Musically, I still didn't even really like, even when I was going to hardcore shows every weekend, I didn't really even like that many hardcore bands. Mm-hmm. You know, it was more about, these are the first group of people that I actually feel comfortable around.
Sure. Yeah, you gravitated towards the sense of community because, you know, even though obviously metal music has their own community, it's far removed.
Not at that time. There was there was no metal. As far as living in central New Jersey in the mid to late 90s, there was no metal scene.
Got it.
My first show I ever went to was 1996 with Pantera, White Zombie, Deftones at what's now called the Izod Center, where like the New Jersey Nets used to play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, huge, you know, whatever, 12, 13,000 people, how many people were there. And then the next show I went to was a hardcore show. And I didn't go to another like big metal show for probably like 3 or 4 years.
Got it.
Even though that was like my roots, it was hard to identify with that because it seemed so bigger than anything you could touch. There wasn't a lot. I remember going to the Pantera show being scared.
Right.
You know, and like you watch the Pantera videos and stuff, and you're like, you know, I was worried there was going to be like white power people there. And like, you know, and you know, because that was like the vibe it kind of put off. Like it didn't matter to me. Like it's not like I was like, oh, Pantera hates me or whatever. It's just, you know, you definitely have these, you know, there's so many kind of cultural avenues you have to walk down. You know, it's like, think about this. I was, you know, me and my brother, two half black kids growing up in a city, all black and Hispanic people with a white father who liked black culture. But then we got into heavy metal where there were no black people there.
Yeah, you guys were, it's like you're like a niche of a segment of a niche. Like,
I think it's funny. So we went to high school, right? And we liked metal. You know, that, you know, by the time we got in high school, we had like discovered music and stuff. You know, when you're a little kid, you don't really have that kind of things. But we were, you know, because of the environment, it was kind of a secret. You know, there was really no one to talk about it with. I think I had one friend mm-hmm. that I could talk about metal with. Then we ended up going to private school with all rich white kids, and they didn't like metal either.
Weird.
they liked, you know, Dave Matthews Band, you know, Biggie Smalls, and their thing of just never really fitting in anywhere, and being, you know, somewhat of a an outlier.
Yeah, no, that I could easily see that. Well, I mean, it's cool that you obviously were able to kind of insert yourself into, you know, the, like you said, the hardcore community and be like involved in that. So did you always have a desire to be like, all right, I want to play in a band. I would like to play in a band with my brother. Because like you said, you guys were attached at the hip. Like, you know, how did that genesis come where, you know, once you saw bands play, you were like, yo, I need to do this?
Well, I just think, you know, and maybe you identify with this a little bit. I think when being nerdy about something, when you're complete, like when you get into it, you're into it 100%, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how, once we discovered guitar and started playing, we just sat in our at home and just didn't leave the house. It's all we did was play guitar and listen to metal and rock records. Basically, you know. So before we discovered guitar, me and my brother used to draw comic books. That's what we were obsessed about. And so then we traded that obsession for the musical obsession, and which is cool because, you know, at least, you know, theoretically from watching like Wayne's World, stuff like that, you know, you're like, you know, yeah, that could probably get you laid. So that was kind of cool. You know, there was something, there was at least a cool factor to playing guitar. So our best friend that we drew comic books with, his cousin, I guess they were like, they jam, they play metal, and you guys should go jam with them. So then like one day, one Saturday afternoon, we just went over their house and met Corey, who's our drummer, and Byron, our singer, you know, and that was in 1996.
So,
you know?
So essentially, like, I mean, God Forbid was like your first band. Like
it was the first band we ever played with.
That's crazy.
We never played with anyone else. Like, outside of, like, there was just some, like, you know, like I said, like the college students, like the grad students that were friends with our, you know, they were older. They were like, you know, they were like adults, and they were like, you know, they were like in their mid, late 20s, and they'd like show us some guitar stuff. But it wasn't like we were jamming. But we never had any aspirations of like being in a band. I think it's just this thing where it just happened, mm-hmm. and we jammed, and it wasn't even good.
Oh, no. If you were good, I would call you a liar.
But, you know, we wasn't even good, but it was like, I guess we could do that again. And so we kind of just periodically would go back and keep jamming. And that developed into like recording a demo. And then that developed into another demo. And that developed into playing the show, which the show sucked. And we sucked. So we kind of didn't do it for a while. And then me and my brother really started vibing with Corey. And we kept writing. And it was a slow process. But there was never a goal of like, we're going to be a band. I didn't think that was even a thing that you could be. I really liked playing. I think our only goal was just to be good because, you know, we were in the scene. And when we discovered the hardcore scene, we actually saw some really good bands that we could actually talk to the people. We could hang out with the people. You know, it was like, I couldn't hang out with Pantera. I couldn't sit in on Sepultura's rehearsal, analyze why they were good and how they got that good, you know? Uh-huh. So we just started going to a million shows and watching great, you know, the first show we ever went to was a Candiria show in 96, you know, it was, you know, in 96 or 97. And it was like this band For the Love Of.
Oh yeah.
So For the Love Of was like, that was the band that inspired us to be good. Cause they were the best band that we had ever seen like in person. Mm-hmm. at that time, and that we want to be like that. So if you want to know about like early God Forbid, basically we're like all the classic metal influences, you know, the thrash, the death metal, the Swedish stuff mixed with For the Love Of.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting too, because like obviously during the, you know, mid to late 90s, like that's when, like you were talking about, the sort of the hardcore scene was definitely changing, where it's like, you know, that's obviously when the term metalcore started to become like more prevalent. And so it's funny because the, you know, usually you hear the kind of first band stories of like, oh, you know, we just wanted to play, like we could care less of like the execution of it. You know, but you guys, you know, I like the fact that you guys took a different approach, where we're just like, we know that we're limited by our talents or lack thereof. So, but we just want to make this good. I like that idea where it's like, we just want to be good rather than, hey, like we just want to play. We want to play a show. Like, you know, we want to be good before we really take it, quote unquote, out there, even though out there could mean just a show in a basement, obviously.
Well, the thing is though, individually, we were good.
Okay.
Like, we knew right away, like, you know, me and my brother, we hadn't been playing guitar that long, but we had been so dedicated about it. By the time, it's like the fucking Bill and Ted when they, like, go in the time machine, they come back and they have beards and they can shred.
Right.
We were 16, like, we went in the time machine for, like, 2 or 3 years, and we weren't great, but we noticed that we were pretty much better than most of the people in the hardcore scene.
Got it.
At the time, because we were just nerds, you know, and B, our influences, like, at that time, like, people thought metal was dead. People could not believe that we were playing guitar solos.
Yeah.
They were like, yo, man, you guys play guitar solos, man. That's crazy, man.
Right.
Like, people don't understand, like, it was, like, even hardcore people were, like, afraid to admit they liked metal. The only metal band hardcore kids would admit they liked was Slayer.
Slayer, right.
You know? And then everyone would cover Rain and Blood, and then everyone would go crazy, like you threw a bomb in the pit.
Right.
That's why someone covers Rain and Blood now, I like literally put my nose in the air. It's like, man, dude, that shit was hacky like 12 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, you know.
Can't you find some other song? How about you just cover Roots? Like, do something else.
Yeah, but you know, Throwdown already did Roots.
Exactly.
Good. So that wasn't fair because we did Ozfest with Throwdown, and they played Roots on it. I'm like, that ain't fair. You can't play a song everybody knows.
That's funny. You're like, I want to revoke that.
They were like a company inflating their stock artificially.
Sure.
It wasn't fair.
They were doing insider trading.
But they did it so good too. Like, they fucking sounded, you know, in some ways almost better than Soulfly, how good they did it. You know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I love Dave's voice. That dude's one of my favorite, like, his voice is one of my favorite, like, heavy metal singers ever.
Oh, yeah, he definitely has a talent when it comes to that. I definitely wanted to hit on the topic, obviously, like we were talking about, of race, because, you know, it was extremely interesting for people to, you know, once God Forbid started to, like you said, make a name for yourself, hit the road, and you know, when you were like, the metal scene is notorious as far as, like you were saying, the perception of like people viewing, you know, black people like that, you know, I can't say it any plainer than that, where it was like, I don't know if they're actually quote unquote welcome at these shows, especially, you know, if you're talking about the whole South atmosphere, you know, did you yourself encounter any of that sort of like, yeah, I mean, not like people were maybe coming up to you and being like, oh, I hate your band because you're black. But, you know, was that a vibe that you felt, or was it one of those things where it was just like, if you did feel it, you just pushed through it?
No, I mean, New Jersey is, you know, the Northeast in general, I think is really diverse. You're used to being around everyone. Like, I remember when I was in grade school, I was in like these advanced classes called Gifted and Talented. So everyone else in the school, they would switch classes every year. So they'd have different kids. But I went from like third grade to eighth grade, I had the same kid, same class. And it was me, one white kid, one black kid, one Dominican kid, and one Indian kid. Like black, like boys. And we were all friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I grew up with. And I thought, even back then, you know, and you know, coming from like my dad, who is, you know, lefty as lefties get, and coming from my background, I thought that's the way the world was. I was like, yeah, we're all together. Martin Luther King, baby. You know?
Yeah.
I, I was like, it's like, does racism exist? No. Everyone loves
that's amazing.
And that's the way I thought. I think that's something and especially kids, if you put kids in that environment, they don't think any different. It's like how you grow up. If you grow up and there's no diversity and you don't know how other people live, and the only thing you see is the news media or television or movies, you're going to form your own opinions, especially if you have parental guidance in there that could be bad or good. Coming up, I never really, that was never an issue for me, because I think just the environment was fairly enlightened. And even as a band early on, I think if anything, early on especially, it helped, because at least we had like a story.
Right.
Whereas like a lot of bands, they were just another band.
Yeah, five white dudes getting up there and playing, and like that doesn't, there's nothing really unique about that.
Yeah. The funny thing is, if you go like, I don't know if you can find, but you can find like an old like show review when we first came out. Like so this guy came up, and I think they're gonna start playing reggae or something, and they come out and they cover At the Gates, and I couldn't believe it. Like it was like there was like a factor of people just being stunned,
right?
That's what came out of the people. It just broke a lot of conventions, and even to this day, outside of maybe Suffocation, but even that, there was really only two black guys in the band, where they're just, we might be the only one of the few, like, really mostly black bands in extreme music, that I know about even to this day. And we never quote unquote blacked up our music.
Right. No.
it wasn't like, all right, man, we're going to throw a hip hop beat in here and get a DJ. Right. We were never trying to appeal to black culture. Our, musical preferences were real metal, and was real heavy music. And it wasn't like we didn't like hip hop. We did. That's where we grew up. We all, if you come hang on, God forbid, we were listening to Wu-Tang, and we were listening to Dr. Dre and Ice Cube and N.W.A. We liked all that stuff. We liked everything,
Yeah.
But that wasn't what we wanted to play.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think that definitely makes sense from the context of, where you were coming from. And obviously, I know you heard the joke being thrown around about, God forbid, obviously being true black metal. And like, I know that.
That's something people would say, like, kind of like, hey, you guys are the best black metal band I've ever seen. Right. And it was like, yeah, real funny, motherfucker.
Right.
But then we made a t-shirt basically coining that. And we basically came with that idea to steal Dimmu Borgir's kind of imagery, mm-hmm. but then use it for us. So we took their pentagram they had on the Death Cult Armageddon album, and then put like an Africa symbol behind it. And then superimposed our faces onto like real black metal dudes' bodies, and gave each other like black metal names. Just like,
of course,
it's one of those things like poking fun at yourself and
totally.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that.
With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those, too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
And that's what, like, I mean, I always know that anytime that sort of came up, like, as far as, you know, if someone would mention it, like a message board and like to try to be offensive or whatever, it's like, you know, that no one, like, just because you guys address it and you're not, you know, bashful about it, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you know, it's a joke. Like, I get it. That's funny.
Yeah, I think for us, it's never, you know, it's not something we really spend a whole lot of time thinking about. I think, you know, perhaps maybe 5 or 6 years ago, when the, you know, the band was really, really active and really kind of on that verge of possibly breaking out to that next level and becoming a really, really big band. Mm-hmm. I think they were definitely analyzing, how do I break the band? How do we market the band? How come we're not, you know, this band is selling X amount of merchandise and we're selling this amount? Why, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was really trying to break down, you know, how come we weren't maybe making as much progress as a Shadows Fall or a Lamb of God and stuff. And you know, and to this day, like, I still wonder, you know, if race had something to do with that in terms of at a, you know, in a hateful level. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that you go and play Columbus, Ohio on a Tuesday, and the, you know, the people that come out to that show, they just might personally, you know, and we did gigs, you know, like that 6 Feet Under tour, us and Lamb of God. Lamb of God was basically just as well known as we were, but they were just connected better, you know, and maybe there's something there where you may, maybe you might connect a little more with something that you just, that you personally just identify with. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's just having, it's like being the Jonas Brothers. It helps that you're young, trying to connect to young people, you know. It's just the identifier factor.
Yeah, well, you look at someone, and obviously if they like look like you and they dress like you, it's like there's that immediate, you know, whatever. I don't even know if I'd call it a level of trust. But yeah, like you said, an identifier.
Yeah, or and you could even, you know, go, and that's in a sense marketing. It's like once we started doing all the metal tours and stuff coming out of the hardcore world, you know, we started to quote-unquote dress more metal. Mm. And to try and kind of clue into the metalheads. I'm like saying, hey, we're a metal band over here. And that's just a way of like identifying yourself, so people can say, oh yeah, they're one of us. And that, you know, and even all those bands that came out of that scene, in the hardcore scene, where even if you sounded metal, the bands didn't look metal.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
It was like, you know, it was short hair, it was like button up t-shirts, and, you know, guys look like emo guys, you know, like UFC Zayo, and they look like emo kids, you know, playing like super, super heavy music. And it was like, all, you know, for us, especially early on, it was like that dichotomy of trying to balance where we came from and then trying to transition into being like a straight up metal band. Now, I still to this day kind of question how, if we actually even manage that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
right. Well, it's funny because, not to interrupt your train of thought, but I've always, like, in working with you at Century Media and then also just obviously watching your band progress throughout, you know, the career, is the fact that I've always, like, especially from, you know, in working with you and seeing how you operated business-wise, I always really did respect the mindset in which you approached these, you know, everything with the band. Like, you were always realistic, and you were very calculated in your approach. And I think that was, like, you know, even hearing you just talk about it right now, it's like, you know, there, it's never coming from a point of anger. Like, you don't, you're obviously not reflecting on how the band has performed and you're like, oh, well, fuck that. Like, oh, cause obviously that just will make you a bitter, jaded person. But yeah, I find that whole thought process, like, you know, really interesting, because, you know, all you're doing is just asking questions like, oh, I wonder what would have been if this was different, you know?
Well, I mean, that's a tough game to play, you know, because I think everyone in their life can do that. You say, well, what if I would have went to this school? Or what if I would have moved here? What if I wouldn't, you know, would have dated that person, you know? And, you know, truth be told, your life would be different. And it's hard to say, but all in all, you know, I think things and, you know, are the way they are. And I'm not, you know, I'm proud of all of our albums. We worked really hard in every single one of them and tried to do something that made us, you know, some kind of statement on it, you know? And
yeah,
just being, you know, like, you know, being who we are, you know, from a race standpoint, like I did a documentary called Electric Purgatory, you know, kind of about the plight of the black rock musician. And I went to some random show in Brooklyn and you know, and a black musician came up to me, said he saw me in the documentary and how, you know, inspired he was and was really happy that we're like kind of, you know, waving the flag and, you know, little things like that. You know, I think, you know, or even like if you watched Metal Headbangers Journey.
Oh yeah.
He did like the you know, the heavy metal family tree, and he had, you know, us in the new wave of American heavy metal. And to me, that means, hey, we're part of history, and that means something, you know, to me.
Yeah, no, for sure. And the another interesting thing too, because obviously when, you know, you guys were doing the, you know, largest festivals, you're touring with every band, and, you know, there was a lifestyle that was synonymous with, I mean, there, regardless of what musical scene you're in, you know, it's the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll type of stuff. And, you know, even though I'm sure your band had its fair share of fun times, you guys never seemed, I guess, swallowed by that, or like, you know, that the focus was lost, even, you know, if you were obviously participating in some of those finer things in life, quote unquote.
I don't know. I mean, we were a pretty hard partying band. Like when we did Ozfest, everyone came to our bus. I don't know. I think we did enjoy that.
Oh yeah, no. I'm not saying that you did not. Right.
Very much so.
Yeah. But I guess from my perspective and just an outsider's perspective, it didn't seem like you know, you were swallowed by it in the sense of you know, that there was you lost focus on what you were doing in regards to the way that the band was operating.
Hope not.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's tough for you to have a perspective on that, just because that time may have been so hazy for you. But that's the perception that I got, where it was like, because obviously you see a lot of bands, especially younger bands, once they start to kind of get a taste of success, however large or small that success may be, you know, sometimes it's like they end up drinking themselves into oblivion, you know. And maybe you guys did that, but you were just able to kind of turn the corner, so to speak.
I think that's much harder to do now because of the way the music industry is now. In order to even get anywhere, you have to be kind of self-sufficient. And there's very few caretakers. You know, like back in the day, you know, Guns N' Roses, they could be heroin addicts and drunks, but they had, you know, they had $1 million record deal. And the label was invested in the band. And they knew that these are the way rock musicians are. And they were willing to spend a bunch of money to keep them afloat, to protect their investment. And then management gets involved, and then the management babysits the band. Mm-hmm. And now there's that security blanket doesn't exist. Those big contracts don't exist. You know, other people aren't necessarily there to facilitate your bad habits. And as a band, you have to be a good accountant these days. You have to be a web designer. You have to be, you know, do your own t-shirt designs and make sure, you know, and run, you have to be able to, you know, do the social network. You have to basically run your operation well on your own before labels even want to touch you. And then once they do touch you, like I said, the advances aren't what they used to be, and the leash isn't as long as it used to be. So in this environment, I don't think we ever would have had it. Guns N' Roses probably would not have survived today. Motley Crue would not have survived because there's not enough money.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So now the bands that breakthrough are like bands like Periphery and, like, you know, Protest the Hero. They're nerdy about their music, but they're also nerdy about the way they run their stuff. They're very organized and very diligent, and I think that's the model, at least for underground music. I mean, I think there's still, you know, there still are kind of more you know, maybe seedier rock and roll bands that have a little more of that swagger, but they're not quite as prevalent as they used to be.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And like you were alluding to earlier in regards to, obviously, like you said, you know, you played in a band with your brother. That's never easy. Like, I don't care, like, how close you are to a sibling. I mean, I'm an only child, and I can look at that and be like, holy fuck. Like, the fact that you guys were able to, honestly, last as long as you did. Because, I mean, so he separated from the band. What year was that?
April 2009.
Right. And so, like I said, the fact
you were there—you were there, right?
That's when
you
were. I was. That's when I was taking care of you guys. And I mean, I remember that all like going down and you know hearing about it. I definitely, like honestly, like I said, I was surprised just from an outsider's perspective that that was able to last as long as it did because just of the sheer proximity to one another. You know, you guys were brothers. You lived it, and like you said, you're attached at the hip. So what do you think made it last as long as it did? Because at some point, obviously, it would dissolve, but and not in a bad way, but it just happens.
Yeah, me and my brother were intertwined in a lot of ways. Up until I was like 25, me and my brother were almost like married to each other. Like we didn't have girlfriends and stuff. Like
right.
We were hugging up on each other. It was just we were so dedicated to like what we were doing in the big picture that everything else was peripheral. And it was on the back burner. We shared the same. We lived in the same room until we were like 22. We shared the same wardrobe. You know,
so good. Did you have bunk beds? That would make it even better.
I mean, when we were way younger, but there was like a codependency there mm-hmm. that wasn't probably healthy as adults. That would eventually have to kind of work its way out. You know, and maybe it didn't. Maybe it couldn't have worked its way out in a clean way. So maybe that was kind of bound to happen one way or another because you grow up and you realize, oh, I need to like kind of live my own life and do, you know, and you so you get the urges of what grown-ups really want to do. And Dallas just went hard the opposite direction and got married and had a kid. And, you know, you talk to him, he'll say he basically had the kid so he could leave the band because there was no other way that he could – He told me he couldn't leave the band like normal. He couldn't just be like, hey guys, I got to go, like, cause it's a calling. It's one, we really thought we were going to be one of the biggest bands in the world,
right.
You know? We thought there was like a, you know, so I think the reason why it lasted. So it was, you know, our connection, but there was a chemistry, you know, in the band that was, you know, and musically that was pretty undeniable.
No, I get it. Yeah, basically it was just like you guys. I mean, obviously most humans come to this point when they are, like you said, you feel like you want to grow up. Your brother Dallas had to have a monumental event such as having a kid in order to be able to like separate himself from everything he's known for so long.
And keep in mind, it wasn't just him. We had the same five members from 1998 to 2009.
Right.
So that, I mean, so there was a family construct and there is a much far more than like a pragmatic reasoning to be together. There was, you know, there's deep emotional connections there.
Right.
You know, that it's just, it's not this easy thing to say, oh, I'm, you know, for anyone just like, yeah, fuck you guys. I'm out of here. You know, so there was, you know, that was my entire adult life. You know, I started touring when I was 20 years old, and you know, and I did it. You know, my last tour was 2 months ago.
Right.
So, you know, so that's my adulthood. You know,
yeah.
that's my, you know, adult education. That's my experience. You know, I don't really know anything else.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have any sense of? I mean, obviously now, like you said, God forbid. You know, I mean, you still tour and you tour when it makes sense because obviously, like you said, you know, people are at different points in their lives where you know they want to dedicate their time to other endeavors or whatever. For you yourself, where do you want the trajectory to take you? Because I mean, you've always struck me as a very obviously ambitious person and a person that will be involved in music no matter what. You know, so what I guess what does the future hold for you personally? Where would you like to end up in, you know, 5-10 years or whatever?
Currently writing music for a rock project that this whole time I've been into metal, I've equally been a big fan of rock music. You know, so but I never really had much of an outlet to really explore that. So I was working on a project with Tommy Vexed, who was in Divine Heresy, and then that didn't end up working out. So I had a bunch of material, and I discovered a singer, this guy named Ravi Orr from Philadelphia, and I guess I the way I kind of describe it, it's like kind of like Muse with Chris Cornell singing.
Okay.
So I've been kind of slowly, chipping away at that. He lives kind of far away, so we're kind of like, file trading. And that's something I'm really, really excited about. As far as like, God forbid, I'm not really sure what's going on right now. I think everyone's kind of dealing with their own lot in life.
Right. Well, you definitely get to, I mean, I don't care who you are. You definitely get to a certain point where, you have to, you take a inventory of your life and it's like, well, like the band is still important to me, but like there's also this other stuff because you've become older that is also important as well. And you want to experience that rather than like, all right, let's do the same US tour we've done for the past 10 years of our lives. Like,
well, it was really important. Like, I don't know if you heard the last album, the one we did for Victory, but like we worked really, really hard on it. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy with it. I'm really proud of it. And so the fact that we did and it came out great. As far as what's going to happen, with me, like after Dallas, basically when Dallas quit, then we did like another 6 months of touring. And at the end of the Mayhem Festival, my girlfriend broke up with me. And I had like a meltdown, basically, because I was like, I didn't care. Like I basically almost quit the band, like, at that time. Found a way to kind of, move forward with it. But it was also like, ever since then, it's kind of like, all right, what if this band doesn't work out? Because I never really thought about it before, I'd always like kind of assume that that's what I was going to be doing, So it's really for me, it's still a process, but just actually asking myself the question, what do I want? Because I when I was younger, I never really had to ask that question because I didn't plan on being in a band. It just kind of happened. I just kind of rode the wave of life, and it took me somewhere pretty cool and pretty unique. But I never sat, and I think, and then like, a few years ago, it's like a lot of the, that kind of like self-help, the secret type of literature kind of moved into the, cultural forefront. And this idea of like being able to kind of manifest your own reality, in a lot of, so I think I've been in trying to infuse some of that, like, all right, what do I want? And that's an odd thing. I think I suffer a bit from option paralysis.
Oh yeah, sure.
Where you're like, because America really is amazing. Like you really, it sounds, like a cliche or a platitude, but you really can do whatever you want,
Right.
Unless, obviously, if you're in a wheelchair, you probably, aren't going to be joining the NFL anytime soon. But in general, there's, the world is your oyster. There's a lot of things you can really do if you're just willing to go for it. But figuring out what that one thing or whatever, or kind of reassessing where I'm going has been a really interesting process. I think I've discovered that I want to play no matter what. Actually, I subscribe to, Bob Lefsetz.
Of course. Yes.
So I subscribe to his newsletter. I try to read it every day. And the one thing he says that really resonates with me is just the idea that don't do this unless you have to. And you hear actors say that too, or comedians, it's like this, the arts are not for you unless you're willing to bleed for it, unless you're willing to suffer for it.
Right.
Because there is no, pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. I mean, theoretically, there's a possibility of that, but that can almost never be your motivation because that doesn't lead to good work. There's been like scientific studies on like creativity and output. Like if you motivate someone with money, creative work is actually worse. The only thing that does better is like physical speed and production. Anything where they can exert more energy.
Sure.
You can motivate with the money, they'll get more done. But when you actually have to activate the brain and get critical creative thinking, money as a motivating factor actually stifles creativity. The fact is we create for the incentive of the creation itself. And that's something I've just really tried to hone in on and not necessarily like what I want or where I want to be, but what would I be happy physically doing all the time.
Yeah. That's such an important thing for, I think, people to understand. Because, I mean, obviously, like, if someone told you that in high school, like, you know, that would have done everybody well. And so it's like, I think that because you're able to have these sort of like perspective changing conversations, you know, it's nice to be able to wrap your head around something and be like, oh yeah, like, it doesn't matter if I get paid to create this thing. You know, hopefully one day, maybe that would be awesome. But as long as I'm comfortable in what I'm creating and what I'm doing, everything else will kind of fall into place after that. And that mentality is really appropriate.
Well, I think it's appropriate for creating good art, but it might not necessarily be appropriate for
life.
You know, which is part, you know, right now I don't have a girlfriend, I don't have kids. I'm staying with family right now, and I'm basically having gone long periods of my life without having to work a regular job, and then kind of like, you know, doing a little this here, doing that a little there, trying to figure out, all right, do I just get a regular job and just do the thing and kind of put everything this on the back burner, or do I kind of like just work X amount so that I can use my other time to work on my other creative projects? And it's a tough balancing act, and it's, I think what I'm going through is common, you know, of anyone who's compelled to be a creative and balance that with actually trying to live a somewhat normal life.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's great that obviously that's where your head is at. And, you know, you'll be known that whatever you do, you'll obviously, quote unquote, be all right, because, you know, you're going to be pursuing something you're passionate about, because you've done, that's all you've known for your entire life. So good. All right. Good job, Doc. Good job, Doc. I appreciate that.
I need the encouragement.
Yes, for sure. Well, yeah, for the sake of time, I won't keep you any longer. Yeah, thank you for doing this, dude. I really appreciate it, because you obviously are a very thoughtful person and well-spoken, and that's usually two of those things don't always go together. So,
I'm working on it, man. You know, part of the reason I wanted to do this, I was saying, because I'm looking to possibly start my own podcast. So
yeah, no, I think you would really enjoy you would really enjoy the format, and I know that you would provide compelling content. So I encourage it.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem, dude. Well, spectacular. Well, it was nice catching up, Doc. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, man. Appreciate it. Talk to you later.
All right, bye, dude.
All right, there you go. Doc Hoyle. Good dude, right? Definitely has an interesting story. I know I learned a lot of things, and it's cool just to have that unique experience within independent music. Because, yeah, I think a lot of us are just, you know, white guys and girls and don't experience that type of stuff of like, oh, okay. Like, I just happen to play in a scene where I am the niche of the minority. But anyways, Doc is a great dude. Go check out God Forbid Stuff if you've never listened to them before, because I think you would find some enjoyment out of it. Anyways, until next week, be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo!
Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sort. High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at High Five Casino.
.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.